Facebook, Google, all of these companies are trying to figure out where are the rules and where are they going to draw the line.
There's clearly a demand for renters. They've got most of them full.
If you own a bond in your retirement portfolio, the price of that is going to go down.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
Welcome to Thursday afternoon, everyone. Steve Bertrand here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Very happy that you've tuned in on this. Well, it's a wintry day, isn't it? You heard Dennis Rodkin's voice there. We'll talk to him a little bit later. He writes about personal real estate, private real estate for Crane Chicago Business. And he's got, I love when he has stories about a particular building or house. There's one in Lincoln Park that is being rehabbed. It was left in shabby repair, being brought back to life. Actually, a survivor, a woman who was forced out of her home on DeCoven Street because of the Chicago fire, moved to this house up in Lincoln Park. It's now being revamped and going for millions of dollars. We'll talk to Dennis about that a little bit later. Bill Geiger will be here to take a look at your retirement portfolio. We'd like to start on Thursdays when we can with Ian Schur, a senior editor at CNET.com, to talk about all things tech. Ian, welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm well, thank you. And I was happier when I read the headline about Firefox cracking down on those notification pop-ups. So you go onto a website, and then it would say, like, you know, CNET wants to send you notifications, yes or no. I'd be delighted to see those go away because I never, ever, ever click yes. But then when I read the story, it doesn't look as promising as I thought. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so first off, obviously you always click yes for CNET, but everyone else can say no.
Bad example, you're right.
But yeah, so look, this has been a really annoying thing that's been going on for quite a while. And one of the big problems is that the idea kind of popped up out of our phones, right? People get tons of notifications on their phones. Why not do it through the browser? And the browsers kind of, it seemed like a nifty idea, then nobody used it, and so now Firefox is starting to push down on it.
Okay, so wait a minute. I know about the question. I don't know about the result. So, because I think I've never clicked yes. So, if I did click yes on CNET, say, and then I'm on the browser looking at another website, and CNET had an urgent story or something, would I get a pop-up window, or what would be how would I be told?
So what would happen is that you would get an alert either in your browser, or if you have a Mac, for example, it would kind of have the alert show up just like text messages do.
Okay, okay.
If there's a breaking news story, like when Fitbit was bought by Google,
right,
you would get a little alert on the side of your phone, on your computer, and that would go. And so all of the news organizations obviously do this. A lot of blogs use it now. But what's interesting is that 99% of notification prompts go unaccepted, according to Mozilla, and 48% are actively denied by users. So this is something, even though it's been around for like 5 years, people hate it,
okay,
which is why Mozilla is starting to get rid of it.
But they're not really going to get rid of it, right? Because so, let's say I go to the page, NewYorkTimes.com, we won't say CNET, I get a notification request and I say no, but then if I click on the page, if I engage the page, I could still get the pop-up.
You could, and that's part of the struggle here, is that, look, this is something that all of the browser makers struggle with, is that they're often a step behind what all the website makers are doing. So a great example of this is actually the privacy button, right? There used to be this thing called Do Not Track Me that was in all of the browsers. It's something everyone agreed on. And in theory, if you clicked that button, you wouldn't get tracked. Well, of course, a bunch of websites didn't respect it. Right. People found ways around it, namely Facebook and Google. And so the whole thing fell apart. And this is part of the problem. And I don't know what it's going to change to make things better. We do see people like Mozilla and Apple in particular pushing hard on this, Microsoft as well. And it's notable that Microsoft, Apple, and Mozilla don't make money off advertising. So it's easy for them to do this. But we'll see whether it actually makes any meaningful change.
You just mentioned Google and Fitbit, so let me ask you about that, right? So Google purchased the Fitbit that I've got on my wrist that I use, unfortunately, mostly for a watch and nothing else. But it just shows, are they trying to catch up with Apple Watch? Is it this is about healthcare? What is it that motivated Google to buy Fitbit?
So Google has been actually making smartwatch software for a long time. It's called Wear OS. And if you're one of the super nerdy people who didn't want an Apple Watch but wanted something, you probably have one. And look, it hasn't really worked out very well. Every company out there that makes them hasn't really been able to figure it out. Apple's really taken over the smartwatch market and done it in a pretty strong way. I mean, it's pretty much Apple and Fitbit, very small next.
It was kind of slow. Slow starting for Apple, wasn't it? But they've certainly taken off in the past few years.
Yeah, the real answer was actually leaning into fitness. Oddly enough, Apple, you know, they started it with as a really cool app thing, and you could do all these different apps on your watch. But then over a couple of years, they figured out, oh, let's make it waterproof. Let's make it really good for runners. Let's include all these other things. And they leaned in on the health stuff, and it just went bananas. What's odd is that Fitbit had the health stuff, but they never really had the apps. And so as a result, they haven't been able to keep up. And now they're worth a fraction of what they were a couple of years ago, which is why Google bought them basically on a fire sale. And now we're going to see whether Google can turn them around. But there's a lot of question marks there, too.
CVS is now using drones to deliver prescriptions, or at least they did it in a couple of places this week.
Yeah, in North Carolina in particular, they were able to deliver a prescription by drone. You know, we've been hearing about this forever, right? Amazon started promising drone deliveries a long time ago. But it seems as though there might actually be a way to do this in a meaningful way. And it's notable that this is prescriptions, right? You think about prescriptions are pretty small, right? They have to be moved quickly because they often have to be refrigerated. And the way this one worked is that the drone kind of hovered over the person's home and then dropped it by a line about 20 feet above. And it worked out pretty well, they said. So we'll see whether this suddenly becomes a thing. But I certainly hate going to, you know, the local pharmacy, so why not?
Right. Okay, so there's that. And I think my favorite tech story of the week comes with a punchline. Seth Meyer is going to do a show on Netflix, and they're going to set it up in a way that when he starts to do the Trump jokes, if you want to skip them, you can skip past. Explain that for me.
Yeah, so it's already out. It's called Seth Meyers' Lobby Baby. And look, it's an interesting idea. But basically, you know, as every comedian out there right now, he's kind of dunking on the president. And one of the things that he asked Netflix to do was to build a button where people who might be offended by those jokes could just click on it and skip them. And I don't know how it's going to play out, but it is very interesting. And obviously, it's gotten a ton of extra marketing for Seth Meyers, right?
Right.
We wouldn't
have
talked about it.
So it's just like when a show starts and they ask if you want to skip the intro, right? You could click on that and move directly.
Exactly.
And so you're right.
But what's going to be interesting is that Netflix is a very data hungry company, right? Everything they do is about data. And the reason they release all those shows all at once is because the data shows them that we love that.
Right.
And what's going to be really interesting is if this tells them that people want to click that button, then they're going to probably start adding it all over the place. And that'll be really fascinating, too.
Maybe they'll do it soon for just funny jokes. You can skip to just the very funny jokes.
Right, or you just get the boring jokes.
Ian Schur is the senior editor at CNET. Ian, great to talk to you again. Thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
It's 12:22. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN, sponsored by Wintrust Chicago's Bank. Bill Geiger is in the studio. Our regular conversations with Bill are sponsored by Geiger Wealth Management. Bill, welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Good to be here, sir.
Okay, so you know the Dow is up big today. I was reading an article in the Wall Street Journal not too long ago about my kids talk about FOMO, the fear of missing out.
Right.
And
social media.
Yeah, FOMO is big right now when it comes to sort of protecting your savings. You know, it's tempting to stay in the market maybe longer than you should.
Well, I'll tell you, I sat down with a listener from this show, and he said exactly that. He's 60 years old. He's worried about this market because it just seems to be going too high for too long. But he wants to do as well as he can over the next
right.
5 years, Steve, for his retirement. He told me, he says, I'm not quite where I want to be yet. Now, I've been doing this for 35
right.
years.
Right.
I've never heard anybody say their portfolio was big enough yet.
Right, right.
But he wants to stay involved. He wants his portfolio to stay involved because he wants to have as much as possible by the time he retires. But he's afraid. He's afraid to get out. He's afraid to be sitting on the sidelines. But he's afraid to be in because he could have a big loss. So what we did is we put a safety net under his account so he can stay fully invested and not have to worry about a big
loss. Explain for me what that is. How do you do a safety net?
Well, you've heard of hedging before.
Sure, yeah.
You've heard of portfolio insurance.
Yeah.
So basically, we place a floor under our client's portfolio so they can continue to watch their accounts go up, but they don't have to worry about having a big loss. They're protected against that.
So the floor would be that the you would move the assets when they hit a certain floor? Or
They just don't lose anymore once it hits the floor. I'll give you an example. We have a manager with a 20-year track record that's actually outperformed the S&P after fees, everything. The most they've ever gone down in the last 20 years is a little bit under 14%.
Okay.
And that was in 2008 when the market was down 51%.
Right.
You get down 14%, you can recover from that.
That's a win.
No, that's a win. Yeah, it takes you 15% to get back. You go down 50%, you have to double your money to get back. So it's a whole different kettle of fish. So what our clients like about this is they can stay fully invested, but they can stay fully hedged. They can stay protected, and they're going to limit how much they can lose.
So who is this good for? The people who've got their nut saved?
What's real good for folks that are 5 to 10 years from retirement.
Okay.
You know, they're close enough. They've got more money than they've ever had in their life. Kind of makes sense because they're older and they're close to retirement. And the last thing they want at this stage is a really big loss, because it's going to change their retirement, right. Change their life forever.
They've got a date on the calendar, and that date's going to change.
That's right. They can't have a big loss at this stage, but they still want to stay involved. So this is a way they can stay fully invested and fully protected at the same time.
Yes, you know, earlier in the earnings season report, I think maybe for the second quarter, people were talking about you're going to start seeing signs of recession. And then after the third quarter reporting season, for pretty much people saying signs of recession are gone. You and I have talked about this. Recession will be here one day. But what's your read on that?
We know it's coming. We just don't know when.
Right.
Right? And if you're getting close to retirement, you kind of sort of have to treat your portfolio as if it's around the corner, because we don't know. Markets go down a heck of a lot faster than they go up, Steve. They can be going up for years, and you can lose those returns in a year and a half.
Right.
That's what we saw in 2008.
And that's sort of what your job is, right, is to get people to understand that, not just where they are in their life, but where their portfolio is in their life.
Our job is to help people grow their portfolios, to keep what they have, and to use it well.
Right.
That it lasts for them and it doesn't disappear. So we're first and foremost about protection, but we really need growth at the same time, and we need income. Okay. So our job is about getting people ready for retirement.
And if people come in and say, okay, I'm interested in the safety net, what do they do?
Well, we talk about it. We talk about what they're trying to accomplish, how close they are to retirement, how much income they're going to need. Steve, if folks are out there listening to this and they're wondering about how it works, next five callers, we're going to sit down with folks and go through, on a complimentary basis, a full retirement plan. We'll put it together for them. And as part of that plan, we'll show them exactly how to protect your portfolio like this.
Bill Geiger, great to see you again.
Good to see you, sir.
Thanks very much, Dave Schwann. Steve Bertrand here. It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN, sponsored by Wintrust Chicago's Bank, and we thank them for that. Dennis Rodkin is in the studio here. He writes about real estate, personal real estate. What's the right adjective?
Residential.
Residential. I knew I had it wrong earlier.
Homes.
Okay. Homes, houses. Speaking of houses, you know, we have talked a lot on the show about the Trump tax cuts and the benefits of it, and the harm that it will do to a lot of people, too. There's a story, I think it was last week, that you wrote in Cranes about how Lake County is among the top 10 counties in the country when it comes to potential damage done to home values because of this tax cut.
Yeah, actually in the top five.
In the top five, very nice.
Out of 3,100 counties, Lake County is the fifth hardest hit by this projection. The idea is that because people can't deduct as much of the tax bill anymore, as you know, the tax reform law changed the tax deduction for state and local taxes, so I can only deduct my first $10,000.
Or 20 if you're married.
Or 20 if you're married.
Right.
if I, in many houses in Lake County, well, many houses in affluent neighborhoods have tax bills well over $10,000. So if I can't deduct all that on my taxes, I'm likely to pull back on what I'll pay for a house. The aggregate effect of that, according to this economist, is that home prices won't grow by a certain amount. It's not that home prices will fall, but that in Lake County, for example, they won't grow over the course of 7 years by about 9.9%.
So after 7 years, which is the typical length of a mortgage,
right,
my home will be 9.9% less valuable than it would have been without the tax code.
Exactly. If the tax code had not changed, you'd have gained more in home value than you will now.
Now, will the people suffering the home value, though, that you can make the argument that they're benefiting from the tax cut in other ways?
That is the argument that most people make. There are other ways that you would be benefiting from the tax changes. The question is limited to home values in this case. And so Lake County came in at number 5. Cook County comes in at about number 35, still pretty high on the list of 3,100 counties. The effect in Lake County is 9.9% growth that doesn't happen. Again, not 9.9% fall, but the lack of an increase of 9.9%. In Cook County, it's 6.6%. All the other metro counties are in between.
I think
those
I got them here. McHenry 8.4, Will 7.5, and DuPage 7.4.
Yeah. And one of the points I made in the story is this is on top of our already being a slower growing market than any other big, almost any other big city in America. So it's sort of another limit that is placed on the growth of our home values.
Was Illinois, the Lake County, I should say, the only one of the top 10 that wasn't in New York?
Yeah.
So the other 9 of the 10
were all in the New York metropolitan area.
Wow.
Some are in New Jersey, some are in New York. And the others are, when you come all the way down toward Cook County, most of them are in that part of the country. New York and New Jersey having very high property taxes and also very high home values. Interestingly, places like San Francisco were very hard hit. They have very high home values, but they have very low taxes.
So they have very low property taxes.
Right. So they have fewer people who are deducting more than $10,000 in property tax.
But California's not a low tax state. They're just taxing in other ways.
Right.
Okay. All right. So there's that. While we're in Lake County, I live not too far from Riverwoods, and you wrote about this house in Riverwoods that
Oh, yeah. A really nice one, isn't it?
It's
not your style?
It's not my style. And I didn't know the architect. Edward, how do you...
Humrick.
Humrick, okay. And he apparently built 40 of these houses, and I think I've been in a couple of them.
You probably have. Yeah. If you have any friends who live in Riverwoods, it's likely that they... This is the character of Riverwoods. Riverwoods started developing...
So I shouldn't say I don't like the style, should I?
Yeah, because all your friends are going to say, well, he's never invited back.
I'm not anyway.
It's a mid-century modern style. It's a lot of brick and glass... really nature-infused homes.
Flat.
Well, that one is. Yeah,
okay,
that one has sort of a flat aspect. But the idea was they were not the Victorian that people had grown. These were all built in the 50s and early 60s. It wasn't a Victorian. It was a more minimal kind of a house and put you closer in contact with nature. So Riverwoods is developing in the early 50s, and Ed Ryerson, a member of the big Ryerson Steel family, taps Edward Humrick, who was already an architect working in this style, in this mid-century
modern
style.
In the south suburbs, mostly.
Yeah, well, not only in the south suburbs, also on the North Shore.
Okay.
But all around the region, and then it really sort of booms for him in Riverwoods when Ryerson taps him to build about 40 houses, or what becomes about 40 houses. Also in that town are some Keck houses and some other mid-century modern houses. Many have been replaced. Some have been replaced. There are also newer houses that were built in other styles. But it really sort of sets the tone for Riverwoods as this sort of woody place where I'm living really in contact with my outside.
Well, outdoors. When I think of driving down, one of the streets in Riverwoods, whether it's Port Wine or whatever, I see these houses.
Yeah, Wine, Daiquiri. You've got to wonder about those street names.
Always, that's a story I want to find out.
Exactly.
Okay. All right, so why is it that they're selling so quickly, that they're so high?
Well, I think that they're back in style, first of all. They're about 50 years old, 50 or 60 years old, and that's when architecture tends to be exciting again. Victorians went out of style, came back in 50 years, that sort of thing. Frank Lloyd Wright went out of style, came back in 50 years. But also, I mean, it's a modern way of living that it was modern at the time, and it's modern at this time. Often they were built with great rooms instead of a formal living and dining room because people were coming out of that formality.
You have to spend a lot of money on blinds.
Well, unless you're looking out at a big natural setting, you know,
right.
You don't have to be too concerned probably, but I think some people do. And so I think some people are concerned and put up blinds. I think there's this appreciation for these natural materials that went into the buildings. It's a beautiful way to sort of to live in an informal way. And we see a lot of new houses that are built in similar styles. So that's why I think they're selling really fast, is they're charmers. Not to you, maybe, but to the people who buy them.
No, I like them. I haven't been in enough of them. I shouldn't be ripping on them. I take that back.
Dear Riverwoods, please invite Steve Bertrand over.
That's Dennis Rodkin. He writes about personal real estate, private real estate, houses, residential real estate. And when he comes back, we're going to talk about a story of a survivor from the Great Chicago Fire. And he's going to explain why there were seashells found at the foundation of her house. But right now, a look at the business lunch. Here's Ben Awakenight with the Biz Minute.
Start the timer, because here's the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing and examining Chicago business news of the day. All right, people, we're officially in the holiday season. No, it's not because of the snow. No, it's not because some pre-Black Friday deal. Starbucks holiday cups are back. There will be four different cup designs this year that strike to, quote, evoke moments of joy. If you remember back, these cups were subject to a holiday controversy about the Happy Holidays and Merry Christmas quotes on the side. There always seems to be something out there to debate these days. That's fact. And shifting over to the world of McDonald's, Chris Kempczinski is the new CEO of the world's biggest restaurant chain. And before he got the position, he didn't own a single stock in the company. Less than a week later, he now owns $500,000 worth. He bought 2,580 shares at roughly $193 a piece. You might ask, why would he do that? He's already getting paid a bazillion dollars. Well, high-level employees usually get stocks at a discount price, and they've got to show that they literally invested in the company themselves, proving that the company is worth spending money on. I'm Bennett Wakenight, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Okay, so I love when you come in with these stories of buildings that just tell great Chicago history.
Oh, yeah.
And there's this house that's being rehabbed on Deming, a 7,000 square foot house that sort of went into disrepair, right?
For half a century, yeah, was falling apart.
Owned by one family for 50 years,
yeah.
And they just didn't. And so now it's being rehabbed and it's going to go on the market. But let's start before. I don't know if the woman from the fire did she build the house?
Yeah, she did.
Okay, so let's start in the Coven Street where this mother of three was trying to find a new place to live after the Chicago fire.
Yeah, and she ends up, so she's a survivor. She lived very close to Mrs. O'Leary's barn. She survives the fire. She ends up running a boarding house on the north side, meets a man who has come to Chicago to start a restaurant. He gets wealthy selling oysters and lobsters.
He brought lobsters to Chicago.
Supposedly, he's the first guy to sell, the first restaurateur to sell live lobsters in Chicago restaurants. He had Wilson's Oyster Houses, which became later the Boston Oyster Houses, which were very popular in the 1870s, 1880s, 1890s. They end up with a lot of money.
And this guy's name is John Stiles, Colonel John Stiles.
And so in 1883, I think, they build this house on Deming. Beautiful, big, wonderful Victorian brick with lots of stained glass.
So Deming is like where St. Clement's Church is on Deming, I think, right?
Yeah, just
then it would be west of Clark Street.
Yes.
Right? Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Just south of Diversey. It's in Lincoln Park, but it was in Lakeview Township when Lakeview was a separate suburb. And so they build this house. They fill it with stained glass. On the one piece of stained glass in the foyer, there still is today an image of an oyster gathering ship, which is called an oyster smack, from Colonel Wilson's origins on the East Coast, and he's in the seafood business. And as you mentioned,
they're renovating it. They're digging around the foundation, and they see that the foundation is shored up
by seashells.
By seashells,
yeah. And they so this that's. within the last few years. These developers bought it in late 2015, planning to rehab the house and bring it back. It's a wonderful old historical home. There are some things they have to do. They're building a new garage, and they're digging down into the foundation, or what was the foundation of the barn from the 1880s, and the foundation way below ground, so not something you've just dropped there, are seashells holding up the, and they've dug some of those up. So when you buy this $6.7 million house, Steve,
when I do it,
you get some of those seashells. They've actually got those seashells in the house.
Have they, I don't know. Could you carbon date a seashell? I mean, is there, we're just going to assume they were from the restaurant, or there's no way to prove that.
Well,
right?
I couldn't.
I mean, why else would they be there?
Yeah, exactly. You can't prove that these shells came from the restaurant, but they found a lot of them, and, you know, who's going to have all this refuse, all shells?
Right.
But perhaps, so they don't really know, but it's a nice sort of connection to the story.
So imagine that, the colonel's at his restaurant telling the waitstaff to save the shells.
Yes. Because I'm building a barn out back of my house.
I'm building a house. Okay, so that's a building built in the 1880s that is being restored to loveliness. There's another one you write about in Lincoln Park that's going to be torn down.
Yeah, actually, not good point. Not too far from it. Not quite as impressive a house on Burling. And it just sold in April for $3 million. It's on a double lot. So the house, it's essentially, the house is on one lot, and there's a side lot that is the size of a full, or a side yard.
The owner had bought that before and tore it down,
right? Yeah,
right.
Okay. And they sold it for $3 million in April. And on Tuesday, the new owners got a demolition permit. I don't yet know what they're building. All I've found is somebody found something that said they're building three stories. On a lot that size, you could probably build about 10 or 12,000 square feet. We don't know for sure yet, but they bought the land for $3 million. Then there's the cost of demolition, and then there will be the cost of construction. This will obviously be a multi-million dollar house because you've started at three just to buy the land.
It's a $3 million teardown.
Yeah.
And this is on Burling, so is this in that area where all those multi-lot homes are, a little bit north of there?
This is actually farther north. This is, I don't want to give the address, but this is farther north. Most of those are south of Armitage. South of Lincoln Park High School. This is farther north than that. The big ones, the ones that really caught people's attention in the early 2000s, 2006, et cetera, those were mostly sat on the block south of Lincoln Park High School. But it's been spreading throughout Lincoln Park for years. And again, I don't know how big this will be, but it's likely to be. You can't build as much on a two-lot parcel as you can on some of these five and six lot parcels we've talked about, but you can build a big house.
All right, so tell me about this. You know, there's this movement to have your home guaranteed sold.
Yeah.
Right? And there's a company coming into Chicago with some of the real estate companies. It's called Real Sure Sell.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how it works. Can you explain that for me?
Yes. So it's a response by a big real estate company to something that's going on a lot in the West and South, which is iBuying. I put my house on the market, and companies like Zillow, I can't remember what, I think it's called Zillow Doors, and Open Door, or Zillow Offers, they send you an automated offer. If you take our offer in the next 5 days, your house is sold. You don't have to put it through open houses. You don't have to wait for a contract, anything. It's sold.
But in this case, the realtors are involved.
Right, exactly. So those original ones sidestepped the real estate agent. So now Realogy, which is a very large real estate company, biggest brand that it has in Chicago, is Coldwell Banker, though it has others. They're trying to get in on the action so that you're not going to get this offer from Zillow. What you're going to do is you've listed with your agent, and your agent comes back and says, Real Sure Sell, which is this partner of Coldwell Banker, will buy your house. They've made an offer. A difference is you don't have to accept it in 5 days. You've got 45 days.
So do you at that moment have to say, if I don't get it in 45 days, I'm guaranteed to, I'm obligated to sell?
No. You, at the end of 45 days, never having said anything, you can at the end of 45 days say, okay, I'll take it. Or whatever you want. It's there on the table for you, or as they say, in your back pocket, and you go out and find out, you can go out and find out whether the market will pay more for your house.
Dennis Rodkin, read more at chicagobusiness.com. Thanks for coming by.
Thanks, Steve.